From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump has broken decades of U.S. policy, officially recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, beginning the process of moving the embassy there from Tel Aviv.
While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering.
Mr. Trump said he was acting on a 1995 U.S. law directing the embassy be moved to Jerusalem, where Israel's seat of government is. The president insisted this does not change American efforts to secure peace in the region.
I've judged this course of action to be in the best interests of the United States of America and the pursuit of peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
Arab and Muslim leaders warned the decision could inflame tensions and destroy efforts to reach a peace agreement.
That made me very sad, very angry.
We're here today, we're condemning the American President Donald Trump decision.
Two views on the West Bank. But Malcolm Hohenlein of the Conference of Presidents, a major American Jewish organization, said it was the right thing to do.
It doesn't preclude negotiations over the boundaries of Jerusalem or the future status of Jerusalem. In fact, maybe by putting down markers, we will encourage the parties to come because they know that the train is leaving the station and that they better be on board.
The UN Security Council is set to meet on the matter Friday. A charity group has warned of a worsening humanitarian emergency in Democratic Republic of Congo, with nearly 2 million this year having fled their homes due to insecurity. The Norwegian Refugee Council's Erika Bloom.
Less than 50% of the humanitarian response plan has been financed during 2017. Consequences, people are dying and people are getting sick.
More than 4 million are believed to have been displaced in DRC. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he'll seek a new 6-year term in national elections next March. Russia analyst Mark Italy of the University of Melbourne said he will likely be re-elected absent any serious opposition.
He stands for continuity and stability, and that's what they probably want to project at this stage. It's very unlikely that he would face any serious opposition.
The 65-year-old Mr. Putin, in power as either president or prime minister for the last 18 years, has led the country longer than any other leader since the 1917 communist revolution, except Joseph Stalin. The Russian leader said Wednesday that Russia will not prevent its athletes from competing in the 2018 Winter Games, a day after the International Olympic Committee banned the Russian team over doping allegations. Speaking at an auto manufacturer, the Russian leader said there would be no blockade. The IOC ruled Tuesday that individual Russians who are drug tested and are cleared may still compete. The Russian leader also proclaimed Wednesday that the Islamic State insurgency has suffered a complete defeat in eastern Syria, the result of separate assaults from Russian-backed government forces and U.S.-backed rebels. Meanwhile, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said up to 24 civilians may have been killed by Russian airstrikes in attacks east of the Euphrates River. North Korea's foreign ministry late Wednesday warned that joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises this week and ongoing U.S. verbal threats make the outbreak of war an established fact. A spokesman said the remaining question now is when will war break out? It's just more bluster, says Korea analyst Sung-Yoon Lee of Tufts University.
Every time the U.S. comes up with a new sanctions policy toward North Korea, every time the U.N. passes a security resolution against North Korea, every time a South Korean NGO dares to criticize North Korea's human rights, North Korea says this is an act of war. We are on the brink of war.
Tensions are high following the North's latest test of a new intercontinental ballistic missile it said can carry a nuclear warhead to any target in the U.S. French President Emmanuel Macron Wednesday visited Algeria, a former colony, saying he came as a friend and appealed to Algerians to look to the future and not dwell on the colonial past, which included a brutal independence war that killed hundreds of thousands. Mr. Macron, who met with his Algerian counterpart, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, has described French colonial rule as a crime against humanity, but stopped short of an apology. U.S. stocks little changed in Wednesday trading following release of data showing slower job growth in November. Energy shares were hit by news. Oil prices have plunged to a 2-year low. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee pledges U.S. support for Zimbabwe's new government.
I think the positive moment for Zimbabwe was the peaceful transition. To the extent that there was not a bloody coup, I am grateful for that.
Zimbabwe's new government launches Operation Restore Sanity to forcibly remove illegal vendors from the major cities. South Sudan's former detainees lobby Washington to intervene in reviving the country's peace process. And who shot and wounded a Burundian East African legislator yesterday, Wednesday?
When the police was trying to stop criminals, police was helped by an East Africa Legislative Assembly deputy, Burundian deputy, and this one has been affected by the shooting of the criminal.
Pierre Nkurunziza is a spokesman for the Burundian police. An early marriage survivor provides free education to rural girls in Malawi. Senegal's much-awaited international airport opens today, Thursday, and the sixth annual festival featuring local art opened this week. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas has praised Zimbabwe's recent transfer of power from former President Robert Mugabe, who led the country for 37 years, to his former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa following a military-led intervention. Jackson Lee says she's grateful for the peaceful transfer of power. Congresswoman Lee, currently serving her 11th term as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, said what happened to former President Mugabe is now in the hands of the Zimbabwean people. She pledged continued U.S. support. Jackson Lee urged the new government of President Mnangagwa to divest power to its citizens.
I wish for Zimbabwe peace and a strong government for the people. I think the positive moment for Zimbabwe was the peaceful transition. To the extent that there was not a bloody coup, I am grateful for that. I hope that the transition speaks not to power for one, but power for all of the people. And the treatment of the elder statesmen should be that of the Zimbabwe people. And we in the United States should look to stand up the country to help its citizens as much as possible.
That's U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas commenting on recent developments in Zimbabwe. She spoke in Washington, D.C. Zimbabwe's new government this week launched Operation Restore Sanity to forcibly remove illegal vendors from the country's major cities, including Mutare and Harare. Some of the vendors say they need to sell their wares to support their families. They have pleaded with the authorities to first give them alternative vending sites before removing them. But the government says the campaign is necessary to keep the cities clean. Taban Nare is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups inside Zimbabwe. He says the authorities should come up with a more satisfactory way to deal with the problem because the vendors are also Zimbabweans who are trying to make a living.
My view on this is that we have a new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who wants to show that there is a new sheriff in town. And part of showing that is to look at what is happening within the cities. We know that Harare, being the capital, has had a huge influx of people from other towns and even from rural areas who've been hard hit by poverty. And these people have gone into informal trade, you know, street vending and other forms of informal work. So it got to a stage where even the city council could not cope while vendors were applying for licenses and seeking registration and seeking places to trade from. The city council could not readily provide the collapse of the economy. And in a way, these people had become a nuisance to the city authorities. We know that people say a picture speaks a thousand words. And part of it really is that some street traders have been engaging as forex dealers. Because of the shortage of foreign currency in Zimbabwe, they have been selling the U.S. dollars in exchanging for rands, exchanging for the bond notes, the different currencies that are in use in Zimbabwe. So this is an attempt to to control and to command the economy.
This problem is not unique to Zimbabwe alone. I can say probably almost every major African city has the problem. For example, I was in Liberia in September this year, and the same thing, where you have these vendors trading their wares in some streets in the city, is removing the people forcibly the way to do it, or making sure you find a location for them before you remove them.
Definitely. There are so many vendors organizations in Africa that are working to try and convince both central governments and local governments that there is a better way of doing things. Because vendors are citizens. They have a right to do business. They have a right to trade. So the idea is to create inclusive African cities where people can continue with this trade because it's part of their culture. It's part of their economic empowerment. So it's not everyone will go into formal employment. Even in the developed world, more people are finding themselves in the informal employment. So we need to be more creative in our policy making, even in our design of the cities, so that we have these spaces where people can interact, can sell local food, local fabrics, and even these daily supplies that people need.
Do you think that the authorities in these cities are going to work something out, or they, as the government, as some of these officials are saying, that they are determined to keep the cities clean?
I think local authorities in Africa are not very clear about what the opportunity presented by these vendors. There is an opportunity to gain taxes when vendors are properly registered and have been allocated places where they are trading from. So simply removing them is not a solution.
Tabang Nare is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups inside Zimbabwe. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Dallas in Texas. Some former political detainees of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement are in Washington, D.C. this week to try to convince U.S. officials that the crisis in South Sudan needs an urgent intervention. One member, Kosti Manambe, says part of the group's message is to appeal to the friends of South Sudan in the United States to intervene in reviving the country's collapsed 2015 peace agreement.
We are saying that there are many parts of the agreement that can never be revived, that can never be implemented, because they are either obsolete or irrelevant. Things connected with security arrangements, with governance arrangements, just have to be totally revised, maybe overhauled, and new ones put in place.
Let me take you back to SPLM reunification. Yeah. This is coming from South Sudanese. Majority of them are saying, how can you reunify a party that is already dead?
The initiative on reunification is not coming from us. We were contacted by other parties about reunification. Our principle is that we don't refuse to talk to anybody who cares, so long as the issues of concern to Southerners, which primarily is ending the war, is concerned. If somebody thinks that reunification can end the war and wants to talk to us, we are ready to talk about that.
I was speaking yesterday with the IGAD Special Envoy to South Sudan, Ambassador Ismail Wise. He made a point that I would like to bring to your attention, that the Revitalization Forum is not a process of renegotiating the 2015 peace deal. It's rather looking at it and see what can be fixed. So you are saying here that the forum has to look at other issues and see if it can be renegotiated.
I don't know what is meant about renegotiating and fixing. If something is wrong and you are going to fix it, how do you fix it? Without having a thorough look at it and either removing it, putting something new in its place. That, in my view, does not look so different from renegotiating that component on it. But anyway, when we do get there, we will put our ideas very explicitly and clearly on the table. If you are not going to renegotiate parts of ASIS, if you are not going to correct what went wrong, whether you call it renegotiating it or you call it fixing it, it will not deliver peace.
Mr. Kosti Manibe, how would you react to South Sudanese and other critics in the region who are saying the former detainees are just negotiating their way back to power in Juba?
That is absolutely far from the truth. What we want is an end to the war. That is all we are. And we have been willing and able and always talking to people about it.
You have been here in Washington for almost a week now. People listening to my discussion with you in Juba would be asking, what is Kosti Maniba doing in Washington?
We are essentially lobbying for others to support the people of South Sudan, bring about peace in the shortest possible time. We are lobbying and trying to mobilize others to weigh in on the government in Juba to be open to talk, to come around the table with an open mind, but beginning from the point of view of admitting that something is fundamentally wrong.
That's Kosti Maniba, one of the former political detainees of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. He was speaking from Virginia, United States, with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 7th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. A Burundian member of the East African Legislative Assembly was shot and wounded Wednesday night in Bujumbura in what authorities are calling a crossfire. As Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura, the shooting comes as Burundi is hosting two East African community events this week.
Pierre Claver Urakamvye, a member of the East African Legislative Assembly, was shot on Tuesday night during what the Burundi police called a hot pursuit to stop criminals. According to the Burundi police spokesman Pierre Nkurikiye, he said that the legislator was not targeted.
When the police was trying to stop criminals, police was helped by the East Africa Legislative Assembly deputy, Burundian deputy. And this one has been affected by the shooting of the criminal. But these all the five criminals have been arrested by the police and their car seized. And now they are here in the judiciary police for more investigations.
As the legislator is said to have been slightly injured by a bullet on his right arm, several Burundi government officials have been killed in ambush, including last year. A member of the East African Legislative Assembly was shot dead near her home. Eyewitness, who didn't prefer to reveal his name, said that it was a scary moment. He says that he doesn't even know where those criminals came from and that it was around midnight when he heard gunfire and cars speeding down the road. He says that he spent the whole night fearing and wondering what happened to the neighbors. Gunfires have rarely been heard in the capital since 2015 when the protests against the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza erupted. However, last Monday, a grenade explosion injured five people in a bus park in Bujumbura. Metus Ngenakumana is a university student in Bujumbura. He says that the country is yet from being fully stable.
The current security situation, I cannot say that it is 100% very good, and I cannot say that it is very bad. You know, sometimes you find it's good, the next day you find it's a bit scary. It's been hard these days. We had some grenade attacks at the bus station.
Efforts are ongoing to put an end to the political crisis that have rocked Burundi for 2 years now. Opposition members and the government are yet to come on the common ground in a 13-day regional mediated dialogue that is being conducted in Arusha. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A Malawian girl who resisted pressure to marry when she was orphaned at age 15 is now running a secondary school and providing free education to needy girls. More than half of Malawian girls are married off before they can complete secondary school. Lamek Masina has the story from Nsaru, a rural area outside Malawi's capital, Lilongwe.
Atsikana Baulendo, or Girls on the Move Secondary School, is a symbol of hope for girls from poor families.
My parents could not afford to pay my school fees to any other secondary school because they're poor and don't work. They're only peasant farmers who don't earn enough from farming.
Emily is among several girls who are learning here for free. This school is a brainchild of Memory Jazeez and Jetseni, who resisted a push into marriage from her relatives after the death of her parents. But 3 years later, she lost an uncle who was paying for her secondary education, and she left school to stay with her grandfather.
I was the only girl in the village. And when I asked about the other girls, where they were, I was told they are all married. And in this small village, the expectation was that I was the next person to get married.
Instead, she began working as a volunteer teacher at an all-girls secondary school, which had just opened in her area. Here, she became friends with a volunteer teacher from Canada, who later raised funds for Jetson's college education. After obtaining a degree in Bible studies, Jetson shared with her Canadian benefactor, Christy Johnson, the idea of starting the all-girls secondary school. The school gets most of its funding from Rotary Clubs in Canada, where Johnson lives. More than 800 girls have so far benefited from the scholarships since they began in 2007. Some are now working as teachers, while others have graduated from universities.
If I do not have APU there for me, it means that by now I would be home in the village, married, having kids and just a housewife, and a housewife, of course, of a subsistence farmer, and I do not like that.
A graduate of economics from the University of Oklahoma in the U.S., Samuel plans to start an economic empowerment initiative that will help give employment to people in her village. Financial challenges have forced the school to enroll other students who pay tuition fees. Still, Jetseni plans to open a few more schools operating under the same model, and even dreams of opening colleges for the benefit of girls. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
Senegal's new and much-awaited international airport opens today, Thursday. Sophia Christensen reports on the country's efforts to position itself as a regional air hub of the 21st century.
It's all done except the finishing touches. After more than 10 years in waiting, Senegal's new Aéroport International Blaise Diagne is set to open its doors. Located 47 kilometers from the capital Dakar, the airport is linked to Senegal's toll motorway and will be connected to the capital by a high-speed train expected to start running in 2019. The shiny new structure is part of a wider plan to decongest the city and turn Senegal into a major air hub for West Africa.
Senegal already has a comparative advantage in this sector. We are a natural hub, basically only 5, 6, or 7, 8 hours from most places. We are in the centre and want to harness that with this international airport.
Today, Senegal serves around 2 million air passengers per year. The new airport is currently built for 3 million, but the final aim is to extend the building to a capacity of 10 million, which would make it the busiest airport in West Africa. A new national airline, Air Senegal, is also expected to start operating early next year. It recently became the first African company to buy two of the latest Airbus A330 jets.
When you talk about Paris, you talk about Air France. When you talk about Turkey, you talk about Turkish Airlines. No country can be an air hub without its own airline company.
The government is placing high stakes on the economic potential of this project. An aeronautics school and an aircraft maintenance center are being set up to boost local employment. And the airport's location is strategically chosen to promote tourism along the Senegalese coastline. But experts say the government needs to think carefully about how best to position itself on the market.
The state has played its part by setting up a revolutionary structure. Now it needs to transform this achievement. It is not enough to simply have an airport with a lot of economic potential. You need the right strategy to exploit it.
Senegal is not alone in seeking the regional air hub status. Ivory Coast is a hot contender. And last year, the number of passengers passing through Abidjan's Port-Bouët airport rose by almost a quarter to around 2 million per year. Air Senegal will be in direct competition with Air Côte d'Ivoire and Togo's ASKI Airlines, which is soon to start direct flights connecting Paris and Lomé. And as taxi drivers point out, the new airport is not welcomed by everyone.
The new airport is going to be bad for our business because only new official taxis will be allowed to access it. So we will not be able to take customers back to Dakar.
For better or for worse, Senegal is buckled up for a new journey. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
The sixth annual Part Course kicked off yesterday, Wednesday, in Dakar. The artistic event features 20 spaces where exhibitions and interactive discussions about the state of local art will take place. Theo Petroni, communications and visual designer for the event, talked to Ricky Stryak about the importance of open spaces offering insights into culture and its role in community.
And the interesting thing is also this mapping that you get, this map aspect with the neighborhoods, and you can just go from one opening to the other because it will be in the same time, in the same place. So it's interesting because you can literally walk from one to the other. So I think the openness is really important, but it's also important to understand that it's not something like the off of Dakar or it cannot hold like 300 different spaces. It must be these professional venues. And you can see that, for example, since the first edition, we had 34 different places. And seven of them stood through the six editions. So that's really something to see and understand, that the place must be constant as well. Some disappeared, some is new, but they all are part of Parcours.
And it says it's hoping to work together with local cultural actors in Senegal. So besides artists, what do you mean by local cultural actors?
I mean the people that manage some art space or art gallery or that have an exhibition room or a cultural project. So people that can be able to make other people move for the culture and for the art world, to support the artists. But the most important to understand is that, in fact, normally the artists, they should get close to the places where they can exhibit their art. So it's obvious that we leave the places is free to do. The parkour is like a gathering of these places in a short amount of time. But this is a way to give visibility to the artist. But of course, its place, its curator is responsible of the content and the promotion of art.
Is there a show that you're specifically most excited about?
I am excited about everything, about the fact that we can do it once again, you know, like, and that it shows some opening in the future, or at least just to take conscious that something happens in Dakar. A lot of things happen in the same time. This is why we think it's important to show them and to have a global communication and a common visuals and program that the people can see where the place are located.
That was Theo Petroni, communications and visual designer for Parcours. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Senegal's capital, Dakar. And that's it for this Thursday, December 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, for our sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of the UAE's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band,